So, toys. My living room is now the home to many toys. Too many toys, in Bronson's words. Kaysen is 2 years old and begs Bronson and me on a regular basis to come and play with him. We spend a lot of time with toys, and frankly, I get bored of toys quite quickly. Minutes of playing with toys can feel like hours, and hours like days. But as an aside, I truly admire those parents that seem to revel in being with their children all day, every day. But for those of you who do get bored, know that you're not alone. I need to infuse our toy stock with new toys regularly so that I can handle the rather mundane hours upon hours of playtime. But thankfully, I work above a great thrift store, and so I often spend time over my lunch sort of scoping out the toys in the children's section. When at home in playtime mode, Bronson makes fun of me because I spend an absurd amount of time looking for pieces that are missing from various sets. I don't know if anyone else can relate, but it bothers me, it really bothers me, when one piece goes missing. Whether it's a puzzle, those stacking cups, a missing playing card, I get rather obsessed about locating the missing piece or pieces and returning them to their rightful place. Maybe I've spent one too many hours mindlessly playing on the floor of our living room in the past 2 years, but I've imagined these toys, these inanimate objects, to have feelings. How would the other colored stacking rings be feeling if the blue ring just up and vanished? Inevitably, they'll all be feeling that hole that's been left in her wake. This fantasy admittedly sends me pulling the furniture out from the walls and scouring the nooks and crannies in our house in search of that missing piece. Over the past 2 years, while on the floor pushing a small version of an excavator, because Kaysen is obsessed with construction trucks, around an imaginary construction site, I've had lots of time to consider my compulsion of keeping a set of toys intact. This concept of attempting to maintain the integrity of a set of toys is a rather recent discovery for me. But expand that to people, and this is a familiar storyline for me, and one that resonates with me again and again. Over the years, I've come to realize my affinity and sensitivity towards people who seem lost, disconnected, or on the margins of our world. As with Kaysen's toys, I have a slight obsession with wanting to see people connected to each other in really meaningful ways. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Enneagram, but as a 9, also known as the peacemaker, I am motivated by a need to be settled and in harmony with our world. Us 9s strive for a peaceful existence, appreciate stability, and prefer to avoid conflict. And right up my alley as a 9, I have spent the past 7 years of my career coordinating a local program that seeks to bring folks who are socially isolated into relationship and community. It really rattles my cage knowing that loneliness and social isolation are on epidemic levels, and that certain members of our society are more susceptible because of the stigma around mental health, addictions, and homelessness. I would love to see our society change and shift in such a way as to embrace those that have felt pushed aside to the margins because of life's many hurdles. The problem of social isolation has gotten so acute that back in 2018, the UK actually appointed a minister for loneliness to deal with what Prime Minister Theresa May called the sad reality of modern life. The British Commission found that nearly 9 million people in the UK report feeling the pangs of loneliness often, if not always. And this problem isn't only impacting the UK. In Canada, studies have found that 1 in 5 Canadians identify as being lonely. Statistics Canada reports that 1.4 million seniors say they're lonely. But it's not only the elderly. Young people, too, teens and 20-somethings, are experiencing epidemic levels of loneliness. And loneliness, it isn't just making us sad. It's actually negatively impacting our health as well. Researchers believe that chronic loneliness is as harmful to your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Loneliness is even more damaging to your body than obesity and diabetes, and has been linked to high blood pressure, dementia, and premature death. It seems to me that loneliness can look very different depending on the person and the circumstances. The first image of loneliness that seems to come to mind initially is being physically isolated and all in one zone. Many of the folks that I walk with through my work regularly talk about this form of loneliness. Some express a feeling of triumph over finding a new apartment or room in the community after staying for a time in one of the local shelters. However, this sentiment seems to quickly dissipate when recognition sets in that even though they are now surrounded by these four walls, they are otherwise very much alone. It's a new situation form of loneliness. This experience of being literally all alone is a reality for many, but this is not the only type of loneliness that people can encounter. Many face an intense bout of loneliness after the loss of a loved one, after a breakup, during a significant life transition, and maybe even after the birth of a baby. However, the type of loneliness that I'd like to hone in on today is the one that is felt when you're actually surrounded by people. As an introvert, I actually love spending time alone, and even more so now that I'm married and have a young son. I love having the space to think, to process, to recharge. That being said, where I personally feel loneliness most acutely is actually when I'm surrounded by people, but feel deeply misunderstood or disconnected. It is here that I find myself asking, where do I fit? Why does no one seem to understand me? There is this powerful image in one of the Gospels that resonates with me and speaks to this idea of isolation from others. Luke tells us that as Jesus was about to be arrested, he found himself in a garden about a stone's throw away from everyone. I like that image when thinking about the experience of loneliness. When we are lonely, we can feel a stone's throw away from everyone. This is how Luke tells the story. Luke 23:39-44. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down, and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. Again, I love that imagery. Heading to the cross, Jesus finds himself feeling alone, in anguish, and at an arm's length from everyone. I once heard a story about a man who was dying, and he reported this experience of dying this way. He said, "I have a wonderful wife and children and lots of family and friends. Someone is holding my hand almost every minute, but I'm a stone's throw away from everyone. I'm dying and they're not. I'm inside of something into which they can't reach. It's awfully lonely dying." He borrows that phrase from Jesus' experience in the garden and then applies it to his dying. But I think it speaks to something that we can all relate to. This idea that there are times when it seems like we are experiencing something that everyone else is not. I think that image captures well the idea of loneliness, whether it be in our dying, feeling misunderstood, isolated from community, or even just sitting on the floor, bored of playing toys with your children. Being lonely feels like being distant and detached from everyone. For some of us, that sense of being a stone's throw away from everyone is actually felt deeply in our relationship with the church. I still have this strong sense of nostalgia around my childhood and the community that I belong to. A community that was comprised almost exclusively of folks that were members of our small evangelical conservative church. Growing up in a tiny Northern Ontario town, it felt like we were always at church. Church was my extracurricular activity. And more often than not, it felt like my second home. We spent every Tuesday night at prayer meeting, Friday night at kids club, and later youth group. And we were there twice on Sundays, once in the morning and once in the evening. But the one Sunday night that my parents decided that we would just stay home rather than go to the evening service, we parked behind the house so that our pastor and his family, who actually lived around the corner from us, would think that we were out of town if they happened to drive by. This actually happened. While eating popcorn and playing board games, we noticed our next door neighbor walk through the small wooded section between our houses, and she proceeded to actually plug her extension cord into the outdoor outlet on the side of our house. When my mom popped her head out of the patio door, Linda started sputtering and exclaimed, "But you're supposed to be at church!" Turns out that Linda and her family had been using our electricity for the past couple of weeks because they hadn't paid their hydro bill and had gotten cut off. And she could reliably get away with this because we were always at church. My church family was my community. I was known, was supported, prayed for, and missed if I was sick. In high school, I spent my summers lifeguarding and counseling at a local Christian camp. It was a tight-knit group of people that grounded me and gave me a sense of home and purpose in the world. We essentially spoke the same language, watched or didn't watch the same movies, shared a common set of beliefs, and did life together. I had a shared narrative with this community and felt as though I was both known and understood. But this all began to shift and change in my 20s as I began to ask myself many questions about my faith and what I actually believed. Life experiences and higher education pushed me to mull over the evangelical doctrine that I'd been raised with. At first, these doubts scared me, and I honestly thought that I was losing my faith because of the questions that I was asking and the thoughts that I was wrestling with. Fears of losing my relationship with my family and with my tribe plagued me, and yet I knew I couldn't push these doubts aside either. I needed to ask these questions and take a skeptical look at what I said I believed. This has been a long and arduous process, and although I am nowhere near being done with my wrestling, and maybe never will be, things have changed drastically. My personal statement of faith no longer looks anything like the one that I had clung to in my early years. In many ways, what I am now is defined by what I was then. I am not saddened by the fact that I chose this road. I wouldn't want to go back to my old faith, my earlier way of thinking and believing. However, in and through this process, my connection to this aforementioned community, this Christian tribe of folks, has essentially disintegrated. I feel the loss of this community that I grew up in and often wonder how I will foster the same sort of tribe experience for my growing son. This community up north is still, to some extent, part of my life, and yet I feel detached, lonely, and misunderstood, being a stone's throw away. Author and speaker Pete Enns also highlights this mourning the loss of community. He says, "It's not so much about friends becoming enemies, but the more subtle disorientation of not really fitting anywhere. The insider becomes the outsider. Nothing unravels a social fabric quicker. I get it. No one likes their social fabric unraveled. It keeps us warm and safe. No offense taken." I appreciate how he mentions warmth and safety, because I can certainly relate with this sentiment. There is a certain stability and security that comes with being part of a tribe and feeling like you belong and are understood. I sometimes miss this community and ache for what it offered, and yet I needed to travel the road that I did. Rachel Held Evans, who Brad mentioned a couple of weeks ago, a young writer and speaker who passed away just a little while ago, expressed this same ache in her excerpt in 2012. "Do I want a church that fits me or a me that fits the church? God makes sense to me under the trees, and God makes sense to me in poetry and prayer, and God makes sense to me in Eucharist and baptism and community and even creeds. But not in the offering plate, not in the building campaign, not in the pastor who shall not be questioned, not in the politics, not in the assumptions about what a good Christian girl ought to be. Gentle, quiet. Am I selfish for wanting more? And who will bring casseroles when I have a baby?" I don't know how to explain it to my family, to my readers, to myself, that despite the fact that I know these good people would love me unconditionally, I don't want to go back. I don't want to be the change. I don't want to try anymore. I don't know how to explain it to my family, to my readers, to myself, how when my gay friends aren't welcome at the table and my sisters aren't welcome at the pulpit, somehow I'm not welcome there either. I feel at once pride and guilt, the Pharisee and the prostitute. But who will bring me casseroles when I have a baby? I really love this post because I think it so clearly illustrates how much she was wrestling with both the loss of a faith community as well as her desire to move on and embrace her new reality. I can so relate with where she is coming from. Even after all these years, I still feel this tension. Sebastian Younger, in his book, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, asserts that a great source of suffering in our world is due to the loss of a tribe, the loss of community that grounds us and supports us. Younger draws our attention to the Industrial Revolution, which required a mobile source of labor. People were uprooted from their land and their tribes to work in factories. Although standards of living and material affluence began to rise, the price paid was the loss of tight-knit community. He goes on to say that numerous cross-cultural studies have shown that modern society, despite its nearly miraculous advances in medicine, science, and technology, is afflicted with some of the highest rates of depression, schizophrenia, poor health, anxiety, and chronic loneliness in human history. As affluence and urbanization rise in a society, rates of depression and suicide tend to go up rather than down. Rather than buffering people from clinical depression, increased wealth in a society seems to foster it. In many ways, it seems as though tribes are pretty crucial for us to flourish as humans. We need tribes to help us carry our suffering and pain. Tribes give us a sense of shared purpose and meaning. Richard Beck, in a blog post, states, "Yes, tribes create tribalism, and there are toxic, dysfunctional, and abusive tribes. But without a tribe, there's listlessness, loneliness, and pain." Nearly 8 years ago now, I Googled churches in downtown Kitchener. Nexus was among others on the list of results for this query. And aching to find a church where I would be known and feel a sense of belonging in my new skin and understanding of faith, I joined my two good friends, Scott and his wife, Crystal, and began the task of church shopping. We hit up Nexus early on, and although we enjoyed the sermon, we were unimpressed with our ability to slip in and slip out without so much as a welcome. My initial thoughts were, too young, too good looking. I was looking for much more diversity and intergenerational involvement. And whether I named it or not, I was looking for a place to make social connections. After checking out the churches remaining on our internet search, we ended up back at Nexus. I figured that I would settle for loose involvement at a place where I could at least resonate with what was being offered on a Sunday morning. If this were an interview, you might be tempted to ask, "Well, Katie, have you found your spiritual tribe here at Nexus?" Well, that's a great question, and one that I'm not sure I have a fulsome answer for. But one thing is for sure, I've begun to think about what a spiritual tribe looks like a bit differently. Many of us struggle with tribes, and for good reason. Tribalism often delineates a line between insiders and outsiders, and something that many of us are working really hard to squelch. But for others, maybe you've been hurt by the tribe, and it's too triggering for us even to consider going there. I get that. Beck states that progressives or liberals lack what we lack and are often psychologically opposed to are actually the three ingredients necessary for maintaining a tribe: loyalty to a group, a shared sense of sacred purpose, respect for tradition and authority. And lacking these binding ingredients, progressives tend toward individualization. That being said, I love, love, love the idea of a spiritual tribe being defined by a community that actually celebrates differences and is about extending the table to those voices that have been missing. Our churches can be challenging places to make connections because pre-existing groups of friendships can be actually really difficult to break into. And maybe for this reason, we need to think about church not a framing church, not only in terms of social terms, but also in terms of being a moral community. Richard Beck asserts that people go to church to have their relational needs met. They don't go to get morally challenged or changed. Thus, if I have a good social time at church, then church is great and fulfilling. But conversely, if church is a lonely affair, I stop going and think it sucks. Back to my example of Nexus when I was first looking. What if we were to think of church a bit differently? What if the goal was not just to be known, but also on becoming a better human? Beck also says, of course, in the effort to become better, I become known. I'll need to confess and ask forgiveness. I'll need to give an honest moral accounting of myself and so on. These things promote community, camaraderie, and even friendship. Paul, in his letter to the Ephesians, refers to the church as being members of the same household that is being built together. Ephesians 2:19-22. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for the dwelling place of God in the Spirit. I love this imagery of being built together as a community that was once strangers and foreigners, but is now kin. With the effort to become more Christ-like and known, we can start to feel a sense of connection and belonging? Will that ache that comes from feeling alone, feeling a stone's throw away from everyone, begin to evaporate? How can I reconcile this? Returning to Jesus in the garden, what we find from Jesus there is this. Within that utter aloneness, Jesus continues to give himself over in trust, love, forgiveness, and faith. It's easy to love when we feel loved, to forgive when others are gracious towards us, and to believe in God when we feel strongly God's presence. The difficulty, the test, comes when human love and divine consolation collapse. When we find ourselves surrounded by loneliness, misunderstanding, doubt, and distrust. In our loneliest moments, be that in parenting or faith, be that in our communities, our vocations, or simply sitting in a pew, wondering what it is we actually believe in. In our loneliest hours, when we feel a stone's throw away from everyone, how do we respond then? Might it be that in our moments of loneliness, in those moments of ache, those times when we feel so distant, that following Jesus' path is what can bring us back? Perhaps what some of us need more than ever in our loneliness is the commitment again to, like Jesus, give ourselves over to trust, love, forgiveness, faith, and yes, community and church. But how do we do that? Where do we start? Perhaps instead of taking the long view of becoming more Christ-like and ultimately known in a faith community, maybe we start small. Saying hi to your neighbor briefly after church finishes, holding the door open for someone as you leave and smiling at them, staying for a soup Sunday, and committing to talk to someone new. In these ways, you are coming closer to God by invoking hospitality, but also performing something small that could begin to change you and others, and in this way slowly become known. These small challenges and minuscule connections eventually lead to bigger things, not to mention changed habits and new ways of being. Now let's circle back to those toys. And in challenging myself to find those missing pieces, somehow I am performing a small act to make something larger into a whole. I'm bored, I'm lonely, and moving furniture to find these little missing pieces is not always easy or convenient. It takes a little extra effort, but not so much that I feel spent afterwards. Is it ultimately satisfying? Maybe. Do I have to keep finding the parts to that same toy? Likely. Even going so far as finding similar parts on the same toy more than once. And you might not find them all in the same day, and that's okay, because those connections are there waiting to be pursued and found. And at the end of it all, the toy in question is a little more whole. It's a little more worthwhile, a little more precious, a little more yours, and you in turn are changed.